All right, there we are. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Pro Photography Podcast. It is Monday, August 18th, 2025. It has been a while. I know I have not been good this year at getting the podcast out, but we're going to fix that.
Welcome to the New Web Pro Photography Podcast, where we talk about what's new, what's old, and what works for professional and enthusiast photographers. Find show notes, videos, and more at simonfx.com/podcast.
Today's show is live on my channel. I'll explain why we're going to do more of that as well. We're going to talk about what cameras are doing because things are really off the hook in 2025. I think we might be able to blame it on Gen Zers, but it's a little more complicated than that. Frankly, I think we're kind of just being screwed over by camera manufacturers. That's going to get interesting. And as we see AI completely dominating, ruining, and maybe bringing back to life real photography, it's going to get pretty wild in the coming months and certainly in the next coming years. Now, for those listening on the audio version of the podcast, as always, I'm going to be talking as visually as possible. Now, this show is also airing live on my channel. For those of you that catch it live and that want to interact with the comments and share your thoughts on today's ideas, we probably won't have a lot of live viewers in the podcast at the moment because the channel is still growing. A lot of my emphasis has been put on videos the past couple years, and which is why it's kind of taken some time to reboot the Pro Photography Podcast 2.0 after years and years, because back in the early 2000s, it was a pretty big photo podcast. And we're going to come back to that because there is something about being able to listen to an audio podcast. That said, if you're not watching the live version, by all means, and you're listening to the audio version, I will link the video of today's show in the show notes over at simonfx.com/podcast, so that if there's something we're talking about that's particularly visual and you want to see, you can do that. But I'll also try and keep links and show notes and stuff alive, just like a normal audio podcast. So it's good to see a few of you in here on the live stream. And if no one's here, that's okay. I'm still going to be recording this and then posting it to the podcast feed. I see my buddy Fitzcam in there. Good to see you. I know Fitz does a lot of video stuff, a lot of high level sports stuff with stadiums and these lenses that cost, you know, 200 grand, some pretty wild stuff. So maybe that's something we'll have to talk about. But I want to kind of catch up because this year in 2025, cameras have been doing crazy things. On a lot of last year's episodes, as we kind of relaunched the Pro Photo Podcast, and I know that this summer I have sucked at getting it out, but one of the things we talked about a lot on the podcast this last year is just what AI was doing. And if you go back and you've heard those episodes, you know that I was kind of watching, experimenting, even trying some of this myself. And I've seen this AI just kind of explode in a very disturbing way. But at the same time, a lot of pushback as people realize that AI isn't creating art, that the images made with art are not AI. In fact, you can't even copyright these images because they're not your art. Something generated by a computer model isn't art. So, you know, when we take a camera and we go out and we take real photos, whether they're on film or whether they're on digital, we're seeing, we're composing, we're visualizing. Then you come to AI and you can see all of this perfection, but also without a soul. And effectively, what is going on, and there's a lot of dispute, right? There's a lot of YouTubers talking about this. There's videos in the art world, right? The world of painting and things like that. That side of the art world is very offended. Of course, the fine art world is allowed to get more offended, I think, than us photographers. They've always been more offended. No offense to those of you that are painters, because I've studied the painters a lot to learn about creating photography. That's where we inherited this profession from. But as photographers, I think we've kind of always had to just kind of suck it up and be like, you know, oh, you're not important. Everyone's a photographer. Everyone owns a cell phone. Everyone owns a camera. But speaking of cell phones, things are getting crazy there too, because Gen Z is abandoning their cell phones for real cameras, dare I say. And I shouldn't just say Gen Z. A lot of people are, but as someone who started in the first days of digital, as a millennial, I guess you'd call me, and who actually started on film, a lot of my peers in photography did not start on film. They came in when they were 20 somethings and picked up digital cameras and thought it was great. And so I am in a way kind of the old school, even though technically I'm in kind of the millennial crowd, being 40 years old now. So now I'm old. But those you old timers in here, you know, a lot of times will watch my videos and look at me and think, oh, he's just a young punk. But I was there before digital. And I was shooting film, and I was working on film. I was the Speedway photographer in Afraid of Washington for so many years. That Speedway is gone now. The land has been purchased and turned into a prison. Welcome to the United States of America. However, I'll stay focused. I'm just reminiscing here. But I did start on film, and I saw these changes in digital and things getting easier to edit and everything being in Photoshop in the mid-2000s, and everybody that bought a camera now being a photographer. Of course, that still exists. Everybody that buys a camera thinks they're a photographer. And it's really weird to me. I just have a piece of advice for new photographers. And, you know, because we talk about all things photography on this show. But I do have a piece of advice for new photographers. I see these new photographers, and I recently... It's been a few months now, but I fairly recently did my first workshop down here in Central Mexico in Spanish. Now, I'm thinking about doing some workshops and tours and things like that for English speakers coming down as well, because I have a little studio space and I know my way around. I speak more or less fluent Spanish now, and I know my way around. But I did my first workshop in Spanish, which was a challenge for me because, you know, all these, it's one thing to communicate and order tacos and food and talk to your neighbor, but it's another thing to teach technical things and be proficient in a completely different culture and in a completely different language. So that was a good exercise for me. But some of these people at my workshop, they had literally, and it was funny because I was like flashing back to the 2010s. Some of these people at the workshop, they came, had a great little group. It was only like 8 or 10 people. It was a day-long workshop of like fundamentals of just really improving your photography. And it was all in Spanish. So I did my workshop in my salon. And some of these people, within like a week, they had just bought a camera. And then a week later, they were advertising, right? That they were doing sessions. And I just kind of thought, and I was kind of like, okay, is this how we should do it? Like, should we buy a camera, learn just the basics of how to turn it on and what aperture is, and then be photographers? And I just remember I said to people, you know, when I started in photography, and yes, this one was the film days, and I would go and I would find mentors and I would practice and I would help out in their studios. I remember helping out Doug Miller in his Afreda studio, doing copy work for him and being the grunt. I remember having my 35mm camera because it was all I could afford. But I studied for at least 5 years before I charged. I even attempted to charge for absolutely anything, because photography was looked at in those times as a profession that you learned. Just like if you wanted to go and be a dentist or an engineer or something like that, this was a profession that you've learned. And somewhere along the way, and I know this started with digital, we kind of lost that. And people think, oh, I took some great photos. I have a Boca beast of a lens that I spent $3,000 on. We're going to talk about that today, too, because I had a pretty controversial video that raised a lot of question on my channel last week. And I will link that in the show notes or correspondingly right here in the chat for those of you that are watching the live version of the show. But if you didn't see this video, you want to check it out. And essentially, it's that they lied to you about aperture and bokeh and full frame versus small sensors. We're going to actually come back to that as a closing topic today, because I did some more test images and I will show you in this video. And I'll probably actually cut the video out and save it as a follow-up video to last week's video, because I took some of the comments people had saying that I was wrong because I was asserting that aperture equivalence is nonsense, that it isn't real. And I proved that aperture equivalence is not real to the best of my ability. But I'm going to show you a little more proof in that today. And so stay tuned for that in the video, because it's not just going to be me talking. I'm going to show you some examples here that I think are actually really important in all this. By the way, those of you that are watching live, feel free to leave a comment and try to keep it on topic, but I will try to respond to comments and questions live here on the show, which is also one of the reasons I like doing this live. So do leave a comment, do engage, and let's chat as we talk about the state of photography here in 2025. But the reason I kind of connect this topic where I was talking about aperture equivalence is that we have a generation of photographers now, right? So I remember this change in like the 2010s, let's say, where, you know, everybody got a foot camera at Best Buy and they were all photographers now. And I remember that shift, and you still kind of had to learn them, but you could fix it in post. And that's got even more and more tools and AI and all this stuff that you can fix in post. Here we are in 2025. So another 15 years have passed. We now have a whole generation of photographers that have not learned photography. And I'm that's a shocking revelation to me. And I actually am to Steve's comment. I do intend to do more videos on just the fundamentals of photography, because I'm realizing that even though we have all these influencers and YouTubers and camera reviews and we're always buying new gear and all this stuff, and this will do it, this time we'll be a great photographer, there is very little education on photography. And I mean the fundamentals. And as a PPA master photographer, I had to learn the fundamentals. I started from zero before we had YouTube, and, you know, buying photo magazines and beating my head against the wall and learning Photoshop in the Photoshop 4 days. And it was a different world then. But what's interesting to me is now we have AI. And AI is in one way, yes, taking over, because almost all the viral things you see from unethical social media platforms like Facebook and all these shorts on YouTube and TikTok, they're being taken over, right, by these very plagiaristic and oftentimes very unhealthy. I mean, I see now kids shows and they're just all created with AI, and there's no thought to whether this is healthy or whether this is good. It's just cranking out content. And I think we're going to start seeing a lot of pushback on AI. I'm not saying that, you know, an AI chatbot isn't useful. You know, we have Grok and we have OpenAI and ChatGPT, all this kind of stuff. And it can be useful, but I don't take it seriously. Like, I would never, none of the articles on my blog are written by AI. My posts on Facebook, I don't go to AI to write my content, because that content needs to be me, even if it can copy my style. There's something fundamentally and terribly wrong with what's going on with AI. And while I think AI can be useful in a search sense, and, you know, I might use an AI chatbot to ask some questions and like compare, I can be driving down the road and talking to an AI chatbot about different cameras, different sensors, different rules in photography to remind myself before I go to a video. Of course, I do need to make sure I kind of know the topic, because sometimes AI just gaslights you. That's another thing. But I don't want to go too deep down the AI rabbit hole, other than that people are starting to realize that everything is fake, that we're talking to bots on the internet, that we're watching content created by AI, that the videos and the posts and the news photos are not real. And what it's doing is, I think it's making people want real photos more. And so you have this whole generation of, on the one side, photographers that have not learned photography, but on the other side, you kind of have the younger people that are just the up and coming photographers. And you have, you know, the young Gen Alphas picking up cameras, and they've had cell phones all their life that take great photos. And they're like, no, I want a camera. And in fact, we're going to come to that topic in just a second, because our main topic for the day is that the new generation of cameras that we're seeing this year and what's happening with the camera industry is completely whacked. It's unbelievable. Did you know that premium point and shoots from 15 years ago are selling like crazy, oftentimes for more than they sold for originally, because in the past 6, 7, 8 years, camera companies just stopped making premium micro cameras. They stopped making point and shoots because of the cell phone, right? Now, cell phones are great, and you can do B-roll and you can take photos of friends. And people are starting to realize, though, that most of these photos taken on their cell phones don't really have value to them. They want something that feels a little more aesthetic. They want a camera that feels like a camera. All these years later, I can take photos. I can take good photos on a cell phone. But all these years later, I still feel almost nothing taking a photo on a cell phone. There's no interaction. There's no connection between you and the camera when you take photos on a cell phone. And so we have a new and upcoming generation of photographers that we might just all see as, you know, young hipster festival goers right now, but those will come out and be kind of a new generation. We see film cameras. I'm going to tell you something, like, I don't shoot film just because I shoot film. Okay. I don't shoot film just because it's trendy and cool. If you guys remember and you followed the podcast years ago, I got a Linhof. I started on film. I kind of went to digital and I kind of missed film. So I was doing large format film on my Linhof Technica. This was like in the 2009. Some of you that maybe were in, I think it was 2011 or 12 that I was at Imaging USA in New Orleans. And I remember being on the street with a lot of you guys with that Linhof taking photos. And at the time, like, film was not cool. There was only a few weird hipsters. And I didn't really consider myself a weird hipster. I just started on film and I liked film and I was shooting 4x5 for the resolution. Now, film is coming back with a vengeance, even though it's more expensive than ever. Film cameras are very expensive. Look at this. I have two Contax cameras. Let me grab these. I have a lot of film cameras. You can see them on the back shelf. And this is one of the reasons that I enjoy doing this live. But I'll tell you what I'm holding. I have here, this is a Nikon FM. But I actually got this Nikon FM. I've been wanting an FM for a while because I have on my full frame. I sold all my Sony gear, except one of my portrait lenses, which fits on the Nikon. And so I got a Nikon ZF. All right. And the Nikon FM is what the Nikon ZF was modeled after. Interestingly enough, the Nikon ZF is actually bigger than the original Nikon FM. It was a very small camera, only slightly bigger than the OM 35mm cameras. But 35mm roll cameras are very popular right now, as is medium format and some of the larger formats, but it's even more expensive, right? And so there's nothing like the shutter click on a Nikon FM or an OM, something like that. I mean, these are beautiful cameras. I actually bought this because I wanted the 55mm 2.8 macro from the Nikkor lenses, because I'm going to use it on the Nikon ZF to scan my 35mm film, and I thought it'd be a fun lens. But I found such a good deal with this, with a couple lenses, including this old Nikkor 43-86, considered one of the worst Nikon zoom lenses ever. And yet you can find videos about these lenses of people raving about them because they produce so much flare and so much organicness. Do you see what's happening? Lenses and cameras, and then combined now with the perfection of everything being perfect from AI, they've gotten so good that people are like, this sucks. There's no feeling. There's no soul. I want that feeling that I used to have when I had a roll of 35mm film in my disposable camera. By the way, yes, those still sell. There's companies cranking out disposable cameras like you wouldn't believe. And so for those that, you know, aren't into film or haven't done film in a long time, that might, you know, it might seem like nothing, but actually this is pretty substantial. Now here's a Contax G1, the premium of the premium, right? In today's money, one of these with a lens costs like $4,000 or $5,000. If you count for inflation, right? So these were very expensive. The Contax G1 is, you know, early autofocus. And all these new photographers that are all obsessed, oh, it's the fastest autofocus, it's the newest, we have to buy the latest Z9, Z10, Z12, Canon XYZ. And if you guys follow the show, you know I've been talking for about a year now, but I've mostly been buying older cameras. The only new camera I have right now is my Nikon ZF, because it is kind of in a class of its own. I love these kind of retro dial style cameras. I had sold my Sony, and I'm actually in the process of selling most of my Fuji gear, although keeping my X100. But I only need so many systems because I actually am enjoying Micro Four Thirds more than the Fuji. I find it to be a really flexible system. It's very inexpensive to get into, and you can then adapt. If you buy lenses and stuff forth, there's so many cameras because there's two main brands making Micro Four Thirds. There's so many lenses, so many accessories. A little camera like the EM5 Mark III, you can literally pick this up for $500, $500 to $600, and a little 25 mil lens, which is a 50 mil equivalent on this, for like $250. So for under $1,000, and this is a phenomenal, I would go out any day. It's genuinely, even though I have a brand new Nikon ZF, I mean, the size difference is big on a Micro Four Thirds versus a full frame Nikon. Both great cameras. And I actually largely got the Nikon. Yes, I like having a full frame around, but I switched to Nikon because they have such a short flange distance that you can get these autofocus adapters like the TechArt, and I can use all my vintage lenses, including my Nikkor glass, as autofocus lenses. So I'm using vintage manual glass from the 70s and 80s for entire sessions now instead of just for a few photos because it's autofocus. And the results that I'm getting out of it are wild. In fact, let me show you this recent little cowboy session we did with Noe here. And I'll put a link to this in the show notes. But if you look, I shot the 105 on the Nikkor, the legendary Nikkor 105-2.5. And I was intentionally, I didn't put a lens hood or anything. I was letting the flares go and just letting it do its thing and letting that character shine through. And I think this was edited with Filmist, or maybe Belladonna too. But you can see there's just this warmth. There's just this warmth, golden goodness of this thing. And yes, it's got flares. And of course, I could move so it doesn't. It's actually, that lens is really great and sharp. But I intentionally left those in. And this isn't some new hipster thing that I've been doing. I've been working mostly without lens hoods for years because I want the artifacts and the characteristics of the light. And it's just as time has gone on, I've seen how this is changing because there's such a vast difference in these new perfect lenses and sterile images. And they're kind of boring, to be honest. Like the people we're spending thousands of dollars on these lenses. Oh, I got the 1.2 and it's perfect. You know, and I apologize. This photo I just showed you was not the Nikkor 105-2.5. Although I did use some of that on this session and I use that lens frequently. This was the Olympus, 55mm Jizukiyo 1.2. So this is like an 80s lens, 1.2. The size, look at the size of this. Lenses have gotten so huge now. If you look this up or if you go to the video of this, if you listen to the auto podcast, this is a 1.2 and it literally fits in the palm of my hand. It looks like it's a Micro Four Thirds lens. It's tiny. This is with the adapter, by the way. This thing's small. It's heavy and sturdy and it's got huge optic, but it's still only a 55 mil front element and it's a 1.2. Now I know probably one of the reasons these lenses have gotten huge now is because we want them perfectly sharp, wide open. I actually really enjoy the Olympus 55-1.2, this old lens, because at 1.2, it has a completely different character. It has kind of this soap bubble bokeh. It's just a wild lens. But the moment you stop it down, and I love using this lens because Noe here was dressed in this vaquero traditional Mexico outfit, like Vicente Fernandez or something like that would have worn. And so as soon as you stopped it down, it gets vastly sharper, less flare, less soap bubble bokeh. It's almost like having two lenses because you can run this at 1.2, and then as soon as you go to 2.8 or even f2, it has a completely different look, which is also very nice, a lot sharper, a lot contrastier. You may have noticed this if you watched that recent video where I was comparing Micro Four Thirds bokeh to full frame bokeh, and we'll come back to that in a few minutes. What I'm getting at in the long term of this is people are coming back to old gear, old lenses. These Contax cameras are very popular. I just picked up a Contax T. Now, if you look at this, I want you to look at this here. If you're watching online, you can just search this. This is the Contax T rangefinder. You guys remember this? Now, you hear a lot of people talking about, and it's very trendy right now to own like a Contax T1 or T2. You know, Kendall Jenner takes them on these shows and the prices tripled overnight. But this is what's happening with a lot of cameras right now. Cameras are getting incredibly expensive. Now, I shoot a lot of film. In fact, speaking of film, today's show is brought to you by SignFX and the filters like Filmist 2 and like the new Elegance 5 speed masks, which are phenomenal and really leveraging all the latest masking tools in not only Lightroom, but in Capture One as well. So check out the new Elegance 5 and things like Filmist, but things like Filmist, you can go download the free pack of Filmist over at SignFX.com/Filmist, because I'm always working with that. So I really enjoy shooting film, but as someone who likes to be productive, I enjoy having a reason to shoot film. And a lot of times I'll take these little film cameras out and I'll shoot film side by side with digital, develop it, and I use that. That's why my film presets are so, so good. Because most of the film presets and film tools, even the so-called film emulations inside Fuji cameras, look nothing like the real film. They're just naming them that, might be loosely inspired on it. But what I do is I love that the organic kind of grounded feeling that I get from film. I start most of my edits with a film preset like Portra 400 or something like that. And then later, if I say, no, this doesn't work here, I'm going to go to silver. I want some more dynamic range. I'm going to go to natural HDR5. Of course, maintaining that preset workflow that any good workflow has for when we're editing our images. But the main thing is that I always want to have a film camera at hand. And so because things like the contacts and the film SLRs, as cool as they are, if I'm loading up gear to go do a session or go do street photography, I don't want to always haul these two big cameras. So I picked up the Contax T, which is the little known predecessor to cameras like the Contax. And this is truly a palm sized camera, right? It's a true pocket camera that's 35 mil. And there's very few of these that are high quality. You have like the Olympus XA, which is also very good. But it's plastic and it's 80s and it's cool, but I wanted that sharp Contax lens, right? I wanted to be able to really say, okay, this is a 38 mil 2.8 Zeiss lens on this. And it's really a great little camera. But here's what I'm getting at in this overarching topic of how cameras have gone crazy this year. Despite this not being thousands of dollars like the T1, I still ended up paying like $500 for this US imported from Japan. And it's in very good, but not perfect condition. There's a couple of blemishes, but everything seems to work very well on it. But it's not perfect. But I wanted a film camera that I could have with me and put in my jeans jacket when I'm out doing streets and stuff and pull it out and shoot some film. And I've been doing just that with this. What I'm getting at here is all these cameras are going through the roof in price. And this isn't just film cameras. Film is kind of trendy right now, okay? And it has been for years. And at the same time, you know, it's a struggle to get film. Fuji has dropped most of their film stocks. And the ones that do exist are, except the things like Velvia, which are still Fuji. But Fuji's like 200 and 400 stocks are really just Kodak repackaged now. And so we're kind of relying on Kodak keeping going this. There is new films coming out, though. There's like Wolfen, I think, just came out with a new one. And so there's actually new color films, and you still have Ilford black and white film on the market. That's the original thing. And there's companies starting to make new colored films as well, because the film market is so much. Which I think is good. I think people thinking more about the craft of photography is going to improve it a lot. And if you go to Petapixel, right, if you go to the latest news in photography, and you can see that the X half is selling like crazy. And I've said in no uncertain terms on this channel, the X half is the worst camera of 2025. It's completely playing into people who don't really understand cameras. They want the vibey feel that my teenage kids think is cool. And this camera, while it might take cute photos, it's JPEG only. It's way overpriced at like $1,000. You can get so much camera used, especially for $1,000 now. And this is what's happening with cameras, is they've all gone up in price dramatically. Big SLRs, you can still get for pretty reasonable price, and even mirrorless cameras, particularly if they're used. But these new cameras they're coming out are crazy. The price of film cameras, crazy. A little small everyday carry camera, right? The Ricoh GR is like $1,200 to $1,200. This is like, you know, compact fixed lens, 28 or 40 mils that Ricoh GR3 comes in. I don't have one. I've thought about trying one out because I do like little compact cameras that are high quality. If you go back though to the Ricoh GR Digital version 4, this was before the Ricoh GR current APS-C compact cameras, but it looked mostly the same. It was modeled after the original GR 28 millimeter compact 35 millimeter film cameras. Those film cameras still go for like $500. The Ricoh GR, which is a small compact style sensor, not even the new APS-C ones that are popular now, it still goes for $400 or $500. And this is a camera from like 13, 14 years ago now. And these are still popular, and people are going out and buying them. And I know it drives it up when YouTubers talking about them, even when people like me talk about them on the podcast. But it's wild what's happening with these compact cameras in particular, film or digital. But especially in digital, when you watch the prices, companies quit making them. The cell phone came out, and I remember saying this back in the day, like, we don't really need point and shoots anymore because we have cell phones and then we have real cameras. Okay. Well, now that's shifted, because over the years, even though cell phones have gotten better and better and better, we've realized that they don't really give us the feel of taking photos. And so, okay, we want compacts again. You know, you hear this term EDC or everyday carry a lot on the web and in the videos and stuff. And everybody always needs like, oh, it's the smallest, you know, but you look at even Micro Four Thirds, like the GM1, the GM5, these are tiny Micro Four Thirds cameras that are truly pocketable size cameras. And then you can, but you can still put any Micro Four Thirds lens and still have a big Micro Four Thirds sensor on these. I can shoot Micro Four Thirds all day. I could do all the work I do without a full frame. Micro Four Thirds is phenomenal. It's a little smaller than like Fuji's crop sensor. And if you go back to last week's video, we have all these people saying, oh no, there's aperture equivalents. You don't get good bokeh. You have to do, you know, and then people saying, cause again, not studying photography anymore, just listening to influencers. And often the stuff they're saying is complete bull crap, you guys. And saying like, oh, well, less light, you get less light with these smaller sensor cameras. That's nonsense. No one said, here's my Hasselblad 500, right? And I do have a roll of film in this right now, portrait, I believe. But I mostly use this with the non-instant back, and I can shoot Instax square film on my Hasselblad, which is just a wonderful aesthetic experience of shooting instant film, but on these incredible Zeiss lenses on a real camera instead of on these, you know, little pink Instax cameras that you buy. So this is how I shoot Instax. I don't have an Instax square camera. I have an Instax square back for the Hasselblad. And it is really cool. In fact, I believe Nons just came out with a new model of this that's slightly updated. But what I'm getting at here is these cameras back from the day when you actually had to understand how a camera worked to use them, they're coming back into style. But at the same time, the internet is not teaching photography, which is why I'm starting to do more videos on my channel about the fundamentals of photography. And we're seeing things like just fundamental misunderstanding of how light and aperture and things like that work. And it's been wild to watch. I can tell you this, you do not need to buy a new camera in 2025. I did, and I sold my Sony gear to get the Nikon ZF. Because I can't just afford to buy all these cameras, but I can buy used cameras. And then if I don't like them, I turn around and sell them, and I haven't invested that much and I don't really lose that much. And that way I can try cameras. I can do videos because sponsors, I'm way too honest with all these sponsors and always being way too blunt. Like they don't send me, these big companies. Well, they don't sponsor me at all, but they don't even send me cameras to review, right? And I'm not so much a camera reviewer. And usually if I'm reviewing a camera, I'm reviewing a versus situation. Like here on the podcast or on the channel, I'm comparing cameras and what they can do. And I'm oftentimes showing older used cameras. Look at the pen. Here's a pen EP5. You can pick this up for like $250, $300 in phenomenal shape. Look at a pen EP5. And this is a 15 mil or a 30 mil equivalent Sumilux 1.7. Super sharp, super tiny lens on this pen. Now, this isn't weather sealed. It's, I think, 16 megapixels. I could go shoot streets all day long on this. Is it slower than new cameras? Yes. Would I want this to be my only camera if I was shooting a wedding? No, probably not, because it's a little more laggy and slower than modern cameras. This was made, I want to say, in 2013. It's still a phenomenal camera. I can shoot absolutely amazing results on this, and it's tiny. And the other thing is it's cheap. You can get a great 30 mil like this or a 50 mil equivalent lens on Micro Four Thirds that is sharp and high quality and fast and small for $200 or $300. So you can get, you know, really amazing working cameras. And yes, I do like using this with the external viewfinder because the pen cameras, except the Pen F, did not have a viewfinder. And the Pen F, again, you have these companies that are struggling, and I'm like, everybody's like, why on earth doesn't Olympus make a new Pen F? The Pen F is selling for over $1,000. These cameras from just 7-8 years ago, they all stopped making their small cameras, and they all started trying to make these big SLR style cameras, these big mirrorless pro looking bodies, which is fine. But Micro Four Thirds is very well suited for small cameras because their lenses can be even smaller than Fuji's. In fact, they are smaller. The Micro Four Thirds system, even though it has a sensor size that's fairly large, it has more options. It's cheaper because Fuji's kind of got this cult following now, which is one of the reasons that I'm kind of moving away from Fuji. Because like you see with this new Fujifilm X-Half, they're trying to be a fashion brand. And the quality, the build quality of their cameras seems to actually be going down and becoming like more plasticky, even though they still do the retro inspired thing. The X-Half is a ridiculous camera to pay $1,000 for. And if you bought one and you like it, great. But these will be $300 in a few years. Within probably a year, they'll be $300 or $400. They might already be down to like $500 or $600 on the used market because they're just not that high quality of a camera for what they cost. Any of the cameras that I've talked about today, most of which cost less than a Fuji X half, you can get an entire setup in Micro Four Thirds with like an EM 5.3, which is not a very old camera. It's a fairly modern sensor, 20 megapixels with a lens and everything, case, extra battery, the whole works, and spend less than you would on an X half. That's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. And the photos are way better than you'll get out of an X half. This is a camera that you could do professional work with and not even think twice about. So I think that that is a really important thing to understand, that camera companies, they're realizing that their cameras aren't selling so much anymore and that people don't really need their new cameras. So what they're doing is creating, you know, these vibey cameras, which is fine. Like, you know, if they're selling, fine, but I don't think that will stay that way. But I think the other camera companies are really missing out. I mean, all these camera companies, any camera company at this point that makes a vintage inspired camera, but does it well, right? I'm not talking about the X half. I don't even count that as a vintage inspired camera. The Pen, you know, this EP, the Pen EP series or the EPL series, but this EP5 looks like an original Olympus Pen half frame camera. And it basically is a half frame camera in terms of its sensor size, a little smaller maybe, but it takes great photos. But it's about the same size as those original Pen half-frame cameras. So there's culture behind it. Think about if Canon, instead of all this clinical stuff, if they made a QL17, right? This was the classic fixed lens, 40 mil rangefinder. It's a lovely little film camera. One of the few ones that's still cheap, very sharp lens. You can pick one of these up for like $150 or something like that. And it makes this really high quality camera, very sturdy, fits in your hand, relatively compact. If they made a digital version of this, it would sell like hotcakes. How do we know? Because Fuji's doing it, even though the Fuji cameras aren't necessarily modeled after a specific camera, and they've been doing it for years. Nikon is now doing it with the XF, which has sold like crazy, and people love them, and it's a great camera. Because instead of just saying, oh, we're going to do a cheesy half-ass attempt at being retro like the X half, These other cameras like the Fuji, like the X-T3, like the X-Pro, like the Nikon ZF, these cameras are saying, hey, people like real dials. They like being outside of menus. It's not just about nostalgia. It's also about the fact that we just like chunky dials and clickiness on a camera, a real experience. In an AI world, I think people more and more are wanting real organic experiences. That's why film's popular. And I think it might save photography because people that don't actually have skill are just faking everything now. And those that actually study photography and learn the craft of it and can make real photos, but not with so many filters that you could purify sewage with it, like real photos. Sure, we edit them. Sure, there's presets. Sure, there's masks, but they're real. Or even film photos for that even more organic feel. People want things that are real in a fake world. And this world has become really dark and really abusive, really uncaring and really fake, as we're seeing worldwide, not just in social media and in politics, but in how art is made and in how cameras and lenses are. And so I think that organic feel and creating real images, whether they're digital or film, I'm not even saying like, oh, we need to go back to film because that's going to take over. I don't think film is going to take over, but I think it does inspire a new generation of photographers. And I think we have kind of the influencers from the late stage millennial generation who are now the top influencers on YouTube, and they're not teaching photography. They're mostly just shilling to sell you the latest gear. Oh, you need 100 megapixel Hasselblad. Oh, you need the latest 1.2 lens. Oh, you need full frame and this huge cool lens. Look at what they just sent me. But they're getting these experiences and the excitement of new gear every week because they don't have to pay for it. And, you know, we all love unboxing new gear. And this is why I recommend people buying used gear, because you can get more gear that way. And whether it's a lens or a new camera or whatever, getting new gear, I think the value in it, most of the time you don't quote need new gear, depending on where you're at in your photography. The value of it, I think, is that you can get inspired and go out and shoot, and you kind of find what fits with your style and the type of work you want to do, the size, different cameras. Some cameras will just inspire me. I sold Sony because I didn't want to pick it up. It's not that Sony cameras aren't great, but it's the opposite of retro nostalgic vibe, like in every way. It's computers with a great camera inside. And like when I pick up I actually want to pick up the ZF, right? I think if a camera really talks to you, like you don't even care about taking photos. I will go into my office at 1 o'clock in the morning and just hold it and click the dials. And it kind of reminds me of when I was learning photography early in the days and when I was doing weddings. I had like this almost meditative exercise I would do before a wedding day where I would sit in the dark on my 5D Mark II and manipulate all the controls in total darkness, anticipating the darkness of a reception hall and making sure that I remembered the number of clicks between aperture priority, shutter priority, and manual, that I remembered how to turn the ISO dial in complete darkness without even looking at it and change those menus. So I would sit there in the dark, and I think that, again, we want real things. A dial, an ISO dial is a real thing. A shutter dial is a real thing. It's not just that these came on old cameras, even though old cameras usually had these. It's that they're better than using a menu for the way humans interact and think. And I think that changes the experience. So if companies like Olympus would be like, what are we thinking? The everyone wants a new ZF. Let's make an updated version of the ZF. If Canon said, hey, let's make a 40 mil compact inspired by the QL17, they would sell like absolute hotcakes. But what they want is people buying their really expensive lenses. What they want is people buying into their systems. And so they focused the energy there. But their sales, I think, are starting to fall flat because you don't need the new lenses. You don't need the version 3 of whatever the new lens it is. You don't need the 1.2. And speaking of what you need, let's actually, before we wrap up today, I want to show you, and if you're listening on the audio podcast, I will link specifically to this part of today's video because I'm actually going to do this live. But what I'm going to do now is going to be posted as another video. So let me go over here and go to my reference photos that I set up for this. Okay. And we're going to look at a few things here. And my light's a little bit low. Bear with me just a second. I'm just going to make a quick adjustment if you're watching live. And by the way, guys, put your comments, Dan. Good to see you chatting in there. And yes, you know, you've been in the business for a long time, Dan. And those of us that know, most of the even so-called experts on YouTube don't really know photography. They know gear, they might take good photos, but they don't really know the essentials of how photography works. And that's why we have people sharing garbage like aperture equivalence that has no relation to the real world of how photography works. And I agree, Steve, you know, getting back to the basics. We can always go down the rabbit hole of gear. I watch gear videos all day long and I have a huge camera collection and it's great and it's fun collecting cameras. And if a camera inspires you, I do truly like walking up to my camera shelf. This is why I don't just want one camera like I used to a lot back in my wedding days. Yes, having one camera or one system as your primary, if you're doing weddings, let's say, might make you more efficient because you know exactly how they work. You're very tuned in and your system is built around that. But I very much, you know, you see me pulling out these different cameras and talking about these different cameras throughout the show. I will walk to the shelf and say, all right, what camera do I want to use today? And I'll sit here and I'll be like, do I want a film camera? Which should I take? Should I take the Olympus or should I take the Nikon or should I take the Contax? I'm going to do digital. Do I want my Micro Four Thirds or do I want to get a little heavier and take the Nikon ZF? Or do I just want a good, you know, my Micro Four Thirds or maybe the Pen Micro Four Thirds? Or, you know, just last week, I'm like, man, my X100 has been sitting on the shelf for way too long because I've been kind of focused for the past year on, you know, experimenting with Micro Four Thirds in different formats. But I don't want to sell the X100 because it's still one of the only cameras that has that hybrid optical viewfinder. It's just a great camera. This is an X100 5, and they've gone crazy through the roof. These cameras just keep going up. You know, I recently sold my Sony RX100. I also had an RX100 7, great little camera, but because it had that long 200 millimeter equivalent lens, it wasn't the fastest lens. And I found that I didn't use it a lot. I think I would have done better if I had bought the version 6, but I wanted the version 7 because it has a mic input. I was using it for videos and things like that. I ended up selling that in a partial trade for an Osmo Pocket 3. And even though the Osmo Pocket 3 will probably not be iconic years from now, like an RX100 will. And I might regret selling that RX100. And I didn't do a straight across trade, by the way. But I went and looked at my original order for that RX100. I probably sold it too cheap because I'm like, okay, how much did I pay for the RX100? And I paid $1,200 for it in like 2018, 2019, somewhere in there. The thing now retails, that same camera is still the current model. They haven't released a new one. It retails now for $1,700. The price has gone up by $500 on that camera. So this is part of what's happening. And guys, this isn't just tariffs. This isn't just inflation. Like these camera companies, I think what's happening is their sales are going down. And so they're really promoting hard these premium fashionable cameras and charging more for them to compensate for the fact that they're not selling as many, I think is really what's happening. Because there's so many of the used models you can buy, which amazingly still go for a lot of money. I mean, if you buy the RX100 version 5 or 6, you're still going to pay $500, $600, $700 for one, right? And you're going to pay $1,000 or more for an RX100 7 used, because now it's like $1,700 new. So you see, if you watch this, and because I've been using a lot of different cameras and experimenting, I'm actually really kind of on the pulse of what's going on with all these cameras. And it's just crazy to watch what they've done and how hard it is. You can barely buy new premium content packs anymore. You can still get an RX100, but most of these companies like the Lumix, LX10, things like that, they don't make them anymore. You can't buy these cameras new. So the used market's gone through the roof because all these companies shifted and said, oh no, let's leave point and shoots behind. Nobody wants premium point and shoots. They're not selling. Well, guess what? Now that no one's making premium point and shoots, everyone wants a premium point and shoot because they want something that they realize, like, oh, the difference between full frame and a small 1-inch sensor for a lot of my photos isn't that much. Again, I didn't like the RX100. I did like the RX100. I didn't love the RX100, and I found myself not using a lot because, like most of the Sony cameras, it just felt very clinical, very good, but it wasn't a camera I walked in at 1 o'clock in the morning and picked it up to move the buttons and actuate the shutter. It didn't make me feel. And maybe that's dumb. Maybe I'm just a dumb hipster millennial. I don't know, but photos should have feeling. And I've really been emphasizing this in my workshops. If you guys come to my Shadow Hackers workshop or watch my videos here, we're in this AI world where everything's fake. It's easy to make perfect, flawless, fake things. No one needs more fakery, guys. No one needs more perfection. What people want is feeling. And so I've been really emphasizing shadow and feeling and understanding that part because I spent a lot of my career studying the technical things of photography, teaching zones. I mean, I made the Exposed Master Workshop, which I still sell on my site, and it's one of my best works ever for understanding exposure, and it won a Hot One award, and I was really proud of it. But now with like shadow hacking, I combine what I taught in like Exposed and in the later Photo Perfect, which dealt with more of composition and things like that and how great photos are made, and merging that together with shadow and trying to kind of merge that right brain and left brain is really what I've been trying to do a lot in recent years. Because photos need feeling. And if I don't feel something for my camera, it makes me not want to go shoot it. So if Sony cameras make you feel like, hey, I want to get out there, I feel inspired, I feel cool. If I go out and shoot street photos, as dumb as it may sound, I'm like, you know what? I look and feel like a photographer with my Levi's jean jacket, a little contacts in the side pocket, and a Pen EP5 12 years ago in my hand that I can shoot digital with. Now you might be laughing. Maybe you're not, but it doesn't have to be the same thing that makes you feel like, yep, I'm a photographer. You know, I look at a Nikon FM and I think of, you know, old movies like Rear Window and things like that, which that probably wasn't an FM. What I can't remember which camera that was, but you get the idea. Like watching old movies where photographers were running around with Graflexes reporting the news, like in the day when things were organic and real and like everything wasn't just controlled by algorithms and social media. I hope you understand what I'm getting at, and I don't just sound like I'm babbling. And this feeling that I'm talking about, or just having feeling in general as you take photos and in the photos you make, those are the ones that have value to you. It's not the perfect photo. It's not the sharpest photo. It's just not. I do love Micro Four Thirds because I'm like, hey, the sharpest photo isn't the most important. I frequently will go out Micro Four Thirds because they have so much better stabilization than like Fuji cameras, for example, as a rule. Their IBIS is wild. I'm like an EM Mark III. I can handhold it a second. You can get some really wildly creative stuff, handholding it a half a second to a second. Totally changes how you shoot. On the other hand, I'll pick up a Fuji X100, which has no stabilization. Which has no stabilization because it's like, oh, you know what? Sometimes I want even more natural. I don't even want the crutch of having stabilization. I want to see what happens to the blur at a tenth of a second when I just have to handhold it like we did in the film days. So each thing has its advantages is what I'm saying. Each camera has a different ability to inspire you depending on what fires you up. And that will change. It's definitely changed for me over the years. Do I still love making big prints? Yes. If I'm making a huge, big, beautiful landscape at 50 inches, do I want a larger, finer lens, probably on a tripod with lots of resolution? Yeah, probably so. But can I go out with a Micro Four Thirds and then take a photo with it and make a 40-inch print from it that's stunning? Absolutely. This idea that you need 40 megapixels on your street camera is kind of dumb. Okay, you can crop in, fine. But your photos generally have more feeling and are better when you're not cropping in. If I crop, I'm usually just making a slight adjustment. I don't crop as a zoom. I use my feet. Or occasionally a zoom lens, as we talked about recently where I was comparing zooms to primes. If you haven't watched my zooms to prime video, definitely check that out as well. I did that a few weeks ago, and it was also an interesting experiment because people don't realize, and this is another thing of what gear makes you shoot well and photograph well. People don't realize that they shoot completely differently on a zoom than they do a prime. Not even talking about the aperture, the light. You shoot very differently and your creative output is different. I'm not saying zooms are bad, even though I tend to favor primes and think that I'm more creative with primes. But in my early career, when I was doing a lot of weddings and things like that, I had almost exclusively zooms. Now I have almost exclusively primes. You can learn a little bit more about that in the What No One Tells You About Lenses video on the channel, which I will link in the show notes for you guys over at simfx.com/podcast. Even though it kind of sounds like I'm going to all these topics to me are coming back to the fact that we need to understand photography at a more fundamental level, but also understand the feeling of what makes photos have emotion. And new gear in particular doesn't do that. It might inspire us to go shoot, but it doesn't do that. So last week I did a video and you can watch it on the channel to say they lied about your aperture and this whole aperture equivalence thing is nonsense. And we did some tests where I took my Nikon ZF and my Olympus Micro Four Thirds and I did 50 mil on the full frame and a 50 mil equivalent on the Micro Four Thirds. Okay. And so we did these tests and there was no question that the 50 mil on Micro Four Thirds had more bokeh. But the whole context of this is that people keep pushing this idea of aperture equivalence, and aperture equivalence isn't real. And I caught a lot of flack by a lot of these YouTube photographers who haven't actually really studied the fundamentals of photography. And aperture equivalence was invented for the internet. And mostly in the past few years, you got to remember that when back in the day, when I started in photography, bokeh was not even a term they threw around that much. And another commenter left a very insightful comment on that video, because a lot of the old timers were like, wow, finally somebody coming out against this stupidity of aperture equivalence. We didn't even used to talk about bokeh. Everyone was not always panic buying to see, you know, if they could get a tiny bit more bokeh, a little wider aperture, a little more bokeh in the lens to make everything more blurry. Great photos normally don't have backgrounds that are completely blurry. Even in portraits, you generally want to see something. And I can confirm this. My best portraits, any day of the week. And I could pull a bunch up here from various ones. And I did in that video. My best portraits typically have some background. Yes, I like blur and I like bokeh as much as the next guy. And so, you know, we looked and talked about these different lenses in this video, but then the comments came because this video got some traction on the channel and a lot of new people were seeing it. And I don't just want to be mean in the comments, right? Because we're all in different places in photography. I don't want to gatekeep. I don't want to make people think like, oh, you know, it's not good enough. But this idea, people were arguing with me saying, no, that's not true. A 50 mil lens lets in more light. On full frame, you get more light. And I was reading these comments and just kind of blown away with what people are saying. The exposure, I kept trying to say, the exposure is exactly the same on medium format, on full frame, on Micro Four Thirds. In the film days, you didn't call a 35 millimeter camera a crop sensor. Now, understand that the norm was that Hasselblad back there. The norm was a medium format. No one called a 35 mil a crop sensor. That was also invented for digital. And 35 kind of became the standard because in the general rule, 35 millimeter is the big normal sensor. In the early days, everything was crop sensors, quote, crop sensors. Then full frame came out and that kind of became the standard. And so we kind of use focal length equivalent of like, this is the 35 millimeter equivalent as that average. So a 25 mil lens on Micro Four Thirds is not a wide angle. It's a 50 mil equivalent because this is a 2x crop in relation to full frame. So you could say, okay, fine, focal equivalence is useful because when we're talking about, because there's so many sensor sizes and we have phones and we have full frame and we have 1.6 crop and 2x crop, having 35 as the standard because it's the most common, not only in digital, but even throughout the past 100 years of photography, it's the most prolific. It's fair to say that 35 millimeter is a good standard to use focal length reference from, even though if you're shooting medium format on a Hasselblad, you don't need to say 35 mil equivalents, really. It's like 80 mil. It's my normal lens, right? But fine. I use 35 millimeter equivalents as well. What is a lie is aperture equivalents, because people say, no, if you have a 25 1.4, it's actually more like a 50 mil f4. No, it's not. It's absolutely not. So what I did, we can go back. I'm giving you the overview, but I don't need to do that whole video over. You can go watch it if you don't believe me, because some of the comments are wild in there. What I am going to do, though, is I went and I took the same lens because people did make a few valid points. They're like, I said, basically, you get the same bokeh if I put the 50 on the full frame and then I adapt that 50 using a vintage lens. I was using Olympus and a Pentax vintage lens, I think. If I adapt that 50 to the Micro Four Thirds, I will, and I can just use my feet and step back and also you get that 51.4 on Micro Four Thirds. It's now 100 mil equivalent. Works great, right? And it does, by the way. There was an implication that you get virtually the same or the same bokeh with that 50 mil on the Micro Four Thirds. And yes, it's exact same lens. The exact same amount of light reaches the sensor. No, this idea that you get more light on a full frame is nonsense. The sensor covers more area. Therefore, the lens has to be bigger to let in more volume of light because it's covering more area. But that is completely irrelevant to how photography actually works in terms of aperture being a measurement of how we measure light in metering. Because in relation to the sensor size, the amount of light hitting the sensor is exactly the same. The lens can be smaller because it doesn't have to spread that light. Think a projector. As you move it away, it gets dimmer, right? It doesn't have to spread the light over more area, but the amount of light hitting the sensor at 1.4 on full frame versus 1.4 on crop sensor is exactly the same. The exposure is exactly the same. There's no equivalence. You expose the same. Then the bokeh. Let's look. So they said, oh no, you're full of it, Gavin. In reality, even with that 50 mil in your Micro Four Thirds, you have to step back more to get the same framing. Therefore, you have more distance and you're getting less background blur. That's actually true. Therefore, they said you still have like an F4. That's not true. And so even though I didn't do that in the video, I went back and I tested that. And here's the results. Here, I'm going to throw this up on the screen. And for those of you, if you're listening to the podcast, you can go watch this video there. There's definitely more blur on here, and I had to double my length. So I was like 4 feet away with the 50 mil to get this framing, and to get the same framing on Micro Four Thirds, I had to move to like 7 or 8 foot away. I had to double the distance because it's a 2x crop. The 50 mil on a Micro Four Thirds is 100 mil, right? Now, these same things would apply close to a Fuji, even though a Fuji kind of falls in between full frame. And most crop sensors, APS-C style sensors, let's call them, they fall in between Micro Four Thirds and full frame. Let's take a real test. 1.4 at Micro Four Thirds and F4. Everybody's like, oh, that's actually an F4. No, it's not. Same amount of light. Obviously different sensors, little bit of a different response because of how those sensors work and how wide open the lens were and things like that in real life. Like I know normally you would say, hey, I want to shoot 50, so I'm going to put a 25. That's what I showed in the original video, a 25 on Micro Four Thirds and a 50 on full frame to give the same field of view. But even if you put the exact same lens on these, on both. Yes, you have to step back further to get the same field of view on Micro Four Thirds because it's a 2x crop, and you'd have to stop like, you know, half that distance on an APS-C sensor. Aperture equivalence still is BS. The light reaching coming through is the same on both, okay? The light coming through is the same, and the bokeh is not that, you know, it's your F1.4 is actually an F4. No, it's not. That's like three stops difference, and it's absolutely not. There might be one stop difference in bokeh, but bokeh isn't rated in stops, so it's dumb to even say that. There's not a stop in a bokeh. A bokeh is a measurement of metering and light. Does the f-stop affect the bokeh in relation to its focal length? Yes, but bokeh isn't a measurement in photography. This obsession with bokeh is not what makes good photos. And once again, there's no equivalence. Yes, the bokeh is the same on a 50 mil full frame, that same 50 mil on a Micro Four Thirds, on an APS-C, exact same bokeh if you're at the same distance. The only thing that's changing in these things is the focal length. A 25 mil on Micro Four Thirds is giving less bokeh than a 50 mil on full frame because it's a shorter focal length. And yes, when you put that 50 mil on a Micro Four Thirds and it's now 100 mil equivalent, you probably are going to step back more. And so you're going to get a little less bokeh. But again, the aperture equivalence isn't true because the difference, while it is real, if you double your distance to the subject, you're going to get a little less blur in the background. It's not what they say it is. And we just proved that, I think, once again. I know there's going to be somebody inventing some math in the comments and talking about something that's not actually taught when you're studying photography of like, you know, well, this works this way and this, and then distance and times ratio. And they do all this complex stuff to try and explain it because we're not studying photography as a whole. We're not studying the fundamentals of photography. And that's why I wanted to come back and do a little follow-up on this. And so I hope those images came across, and I'll post this later as kind of a separate video, all right? But no, aperture equivalence isn't real. Hope you guys found this interesting. If you want a more visual comparisons, go watch my original video I did, because I know this one was kind of off the cuff, just looking at examples in Lightroom. And I did a lot more production on the other one to show a lot more different image examples and things like that. All right, peace. Okay, I have no idea for those of you listening to the podcast or watching live, if doing a video like this on this topic is going to work well, because now I have to cut that video out, which I can do, but will that come through? I don't know. If it doesn't, maybe I'll just re-record the whole video on this part. That said, I hope this thing, for those of you that watched the aperture equivalence video in particular, I shouldn't need to clarify. If you understand how aperture works, no clarification is needed, but there were so many people virtually trolling in there, just like, oh no, you're an idiot, you don't know photography. And I just would try to stay calm and be like, no, that's not how it works. This is how it works. This is how aperture works. If you guys get a lens, you know, we're talking about expensive lenses. You want to get expensive lenses, go get cinema lenses. You can use them in stills. They're pretty much all manual focus, I think. But you can get cinema lenses in stills, and you can have T-stop, right? And you can use T-stop. And T-stop is more accurate, particularly when the lenses are wide open. It's not that f-stop and t-stop are a difference fundamentally in what they're measuring, because it's still a stop. The difference is that t-stop measures the amount of light that actually gets through all the elements, whereas the f-stop is based on the aperture size, aperture opening in relation to focal length. So t-stop actually measures the light coming through. But on most lenses at f4, the f-stop and the t-stop will be the same. And there's occasionally lenses that are f-stop lenses that are known to be like really accurate, and their t-stop is almost the same as their f-stop. But in particular, an f1.4 lens in photography oftentimes is more like an f1.8. So it's like maybe a third of a stop difference or something, or even more sometimes in its actual transmission, which is why people pay huge money and why T-stop lenses tend to be bigger and fatter and hunkier and made for cinema work. They're not practical for most cases in photography, and T-stop is certainly not what's used in photography. Okay, enough on this topic of the false idea of aperture equivalence. Your sensor size doesn't matter that much. In fact, I've been thinking about getting some of these really small early digital cameras that have tiny sensors, but they had good lenses, just to show, like the early Ricoh GR or some of the early Olympus cameras, before the only good camera was considered to be to have at least a Micro Four Thirds or an APS-C sensor, right? That's why even premium compacts now have to have huge sensors, because people are obsessed with huge sensors. And Seg asks, would I ever do wet plate? I've always wanted to do wet plate, but it's already very expensive to do film in these times. And I love doing film. I do a lot of film tests to make Filmist more and more accurate. Those of you that use Filmist know that each free update I use do on Filmist, we're on Filmist 2 now, and you know, every 3, 4, 5 years, I do a paid update where I really do a lot of work and like do a paid upgrade. But most of the updates on Filmist are free updates for people that own Filmist. And I'm always shooting film, testing with film, and then comparing it with digital side by side. I do like shooting large format 4x5 sheet film. You can see some sheet film back there behind me. Haven't been doing that much lately because it's just, you got to deal with developing. And I'm down in Central Mexico, and yes, film's coming back down here too. And labs are opening up, and there's labs, but not as many, right? I still pretty much have to send stuff to Mexico City to get developing and scanning. Even I can scan myself. I could even develop myself. I have a Jobo in my things backup stored away somewhere in the United States, but getting that big stuff down here is hard. I have a Jobo automatic processor. And maybe one day I'll get that down here, and maybe one day I'll be able to set up a full dark room and do like workshops, because it's not like this is just a European or Northern United States thing. I mean, even here in Mexico, a lot of people, a lot of photography enthusiasts are loving going out shooting film. And there's a big vibe of that going on in like Mexico City and things like that. So at the end of the day, what I wanted to do on this podcast, because it's been a few months since I did a podcast, I wanted to come back, and we have these cameras. We have the Ricoh GR4 coming out soon. Bigger sensor, right? We have the Fuji X100 VI with its 40 megapixel sensor. Honestly, like I said, like I don't usually crop. I think the only thing that the X100 VI has that I would really like is image stabilization. And, you know, my Micro Four Thirds cameras have had that for so many years now. So I don't intend to buy a 6. I'll just use my X100 V, even though it doesn't have IBIS. But 24 megapixels or 25 or whatever the X100 V is, to me, is better for your average street photography. I'm working on some books of the streets of Mexico, and I'm trying to document culture. I don't want to fill up my drives with 40 megapixel files. It doesn't mean I don't ever want a 40 megapixel camera. In a full frame large, you know, there's only like 26 on the Nikon ZF, but I could pick up like a Nikon Z8 or Z7 II, is it? Something like that, and have that same system and those same vintage lenses and everything, and do 40 megapixels. Because if I know I'm going in, even for portraits and weddings, I don't need 40 megapixels. You can easily print 36 inch to 40 inch wall prints that'll look beautiful off 25 megapixel cameras that are photographed well. When you start getting bigger, 40, 50, 60 inch prints, at that point, because yes, I sold my A7R II, which is 40 megapixels. At that point, do these 40, 50, 60 megapixels camera come into place? Yes, there's a time for resolution. And that's one of the reasons I shot 4x5 film back in the day. But from what most of us are shooting most days, even for doing most wall portraits, you don't need 40 megapixels. 25 to 30 is just fine. And do I like having a camera around that has larger megapixels available for when I have a project like that? Yes. But most of the time, I'd actually rather have 20, 24, something like that. And sometimes when, you know, I grab these older Micro Four Thirds cameras and they only have 12 or 16, it's fine. I can still I was making 40, 36, 40 inch prints in the 8 megapixel days. You got to understand that. And so, yes, it's getting a little low for a 36 to a 40 inch print. But with 12 to 16 megapixels, I could totally do 36 inch prints and they would look just great. Would I rather have 24 for that? Maybe at that point. But I pick up a camera on a given day based on like, what do I feel? I will genuinely, even though knowing that the sensor is technically better on a full frame Nikon ZF, this is smaller. On a Micro Four Thirds is smaller, right? Okay. But even if I'm going out to do like a portrait session and I'm like, nope, I'm going out to do portraits, it's still a toss up at times whether I will grab a Micro Four Thirds with a 50 equivalent and then like the 56 f1.4 Sigma, which is 112 equivalent, or the Nikon with its iconic 105 2.5 Nikkor. But what I'm getting at with all of this is I can go out, even though I have a ZF in full frame and I know it's going to be better quality on a technical level, the photos I get aren't necessarily better. I pick the camera based on the aesthetic I want for a different day. And so it truly is a toss-up sometimes when I'm going out for a portrait session to grab a Micro Four Thirds versus the big Nikon ZF. It depends on where I'm going to be, how long the session's going to be. Do I want a big camera with me that day? Do I want the big old vintage lenses like the iconic Nikkor 105? Or do I want the nice look that a modern, my Sony 85 1.8. I don't have the 1.4 or the 1.2. I just have the 1.8, but it's a really good, clean portrait lens. Sometimes I want that. So I'll pick the Nikon if I want those. If I want something compact, I can grab a Micro Four Thirds with a 56 mil Sigma, which is 112 mil 35 equivalent. I know I'm still going to get great results and yes, great bokeh because aperture equivalence isn't real and it's going to look phenomenal. So the gear you use, ultimately, I guess what I'm saying is we talked about all the weirdness, how the markets are being affected, how expensive a lot of this old gear is getting because a new generation of photographers is bored with their cell phones and now they want cameras in their pocket and these little cameras are coming back. All these crazy things happening in photography and AI and all of this stuff. I think what it can teach us is that real photos, taking our time and finding cameras that inspire us to shoot is what will give our photos feeling in a fake world. That might be different for you than it is for me, which is why I always talk about a lot of different gear here on the channel, as well as on the podcast. And I talk about things, well, whereas most podcasts are talking about the new cameras that came out. And yes, you know, I mean, have you seen the new Sony RX1R III, another camera, $5,000 for a fixed lens? I don't need to do a whole show on this. There's a lot of videos talking about how this thing's outrageously priced. Sony is realizing that they don't have vibe. Sony's realizing what people like me are saying. I don't feel anything when I pick up a Sony. I know it's a good camera. I can go and take it to work. I can take great photos, but I don't feel anything. And Sony's like, whoa, people are getting bored. They're going and buying Fujis. They're going and buying Nikon ZFs. And we don't have any of that heritage like those companies do. What are we going to do? They're trying to create something that has heritage. They're selling a fixed frame $5,000 camera like it's a Leica. What they should have done is created a really great camera and had it accessible in price. So they create a cult following for it. Sony's never done that. What camera does Sony have a cult following of, right? Fuji has cult following. Nikon has cult following on certain cameras, right? A lot of old cameras have a cult following. Micro Four Thirds, you know, the pen cameras, they have a cult following. What does Sony have? Great cameras. Computers with great cameras built into them. Great lenses. Yes, they're very good. And I know a lot of you that listen to the podcast are using Sony. And I'm not hating on Sony, but a lot of people have said the same thing. Sony cameras are soulless. Sony's realizing what's happening. And they're like, we gotta get some soul, guys, because people are not really needing to buy new cameras anymore. And that is a really strong message. And these companies better get their act together. And I don't think just raising the prices like they all seem to be want to do. I just saw on Petapixel that Fuji's going to be raising prices again. These Fuji cameras are outrageous now. One of the reasons I bought into Fuji is because their lenses were accessibly priced. Their bodies were accessibly priced. These cameras, like my XT3, my XT3, but particularly the smaller rangefinder style ones like the XE series, the new XE5 is so expensive that like the XE3 is worth as much as I paid for it. I paid like $799 or $899 for the XE3 brand new, shipped to me from Amazon down here in Mexico back in, you know, like 6 years ago. Now these are being promoted. And that was kind of that was their entry level camera. Now they're making all these other things. And I think Fuji's kind of actually, you know, going to affect their reputation by doing this because they're making things like the X-Half that are plastic, fantastic cameras at super high prices. The X-Half costs more in 2025 than I paid for an XE3, which was a phenomenal camera 6 years ago. Something's wrong. Something's wrong. And these camera companies know something's wrong. That's why they're trying to make cool things and they're making a lot of stuff and they're just kind of spraying and praying with new products because I think their sales are going down. And we're going to see what happens. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm wrong. I think people are buying more cameras than ever, but a lot of people are going back and buying used ones, which is why the used market for cameras is kind of higher than ever. I'm going to wrap up today's show. We've talked about a lot of interesting things. I hope to hear from you guys in the comments or in your emails. You can email me profotoshow@gmail.com. You can, of course, find the show notes for today's show over at simfx.com/podcast. And you could subscribe on your phones and all that kind of thing for the audio version of this podcast. Or if you're listening to the audio version, you can go to the show notes and there will be a link to the video version, because this podcast was recorded live and streamed on my YouTube channel. And you'll find lots of shorter videos that are not podcast length, like some of the ones I'm linking in today's show notes on aperture equivalents and zooms versus primes and all that good stuff. And just a lot of content focusing, yes, sometimes on editing, sometimes on the fact that I'm experimenting with film and making presets and all that kind of stuff, but a lot about the fundamentals of what makes us really good photographers that can create photos with feeling. All right, you guys, we'll see you next time here on Pro Photography Podcast. Thanks for being here.